Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter.
Hello to our listeners. We are happy to be here again. After a slow summer, we are now picking up the pace as there is much coming up in the climate community in the next months that we'd like to discuss here in the podcast, such as the Berlin Climate and Security Conference in October, the Climate COP27 in November, and the Biodiversity COP15 in December, among others. And before we move ahead, I'd like to welcome our new co-host, Alexandra Steinkraus. Alexandra, she recently joined Adelphi's Climate Diplomacy and Security Program, and we will be hosting the Climate Diplomacy Podcast together. I'm looking very much forward to that. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, thank you so much for the warm welcome. I'm really excited to join not only Adelphi, but especially the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. And I'm really excited to launch off my podcast career with a very exciting guest. So today we have Gernot Leganda. He is chief of the Climate and Disaster Risk Reduction Unit at the World Food Program. Hunger has been in steady decline for decades, but it has recently started to rise again in recent years. The compounding and increasing impacts of climate change, conflict, and several economic crises, such as those that resulted from the COVID-19 pandemic, are to blame for this trend of reversal. The WFP is at the front line of the response to these crises, making sure to bring much-needed food and nourishments for the affected populations. But the pressures are mounting as natural disasters happen more frequently and the number of conflicts grow worldwide. Welcome, Gernot. We're very excited to welcome you to the podcast this morning.
Well, thank you very much for the invite. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start by asking a bit about your role. So as a humanitarian agency, of course, the World Food Program has a more reactive role in light of humanitarian crises. However, when we look at your role heading the Disaster Risk Reduction Unit, it implies having some foresight and also applying a preventative logic to programs and projects. So how would you say that these two paradigms fit together?
Yeah, thank you for the question. It's, I think, a really good one to start this conversation because, as you have rightly said, in many people's minds, the World Food Program is first and foremost a disaster response agency. But disaster response can only ever be a temporary measure and never a long-term solution to the hunger problem the world is facing. So in a way, you see us doing the same things like a country that needs to manage a public health system. It's not enough if you spend the entire health budget only on emergency vehicles. You also need functions that advise people on how they can avoid getting picked up by these emergency vehicles in the first place. So how preventable diseases can be avoided, why it is important to have healthy diets, training people on first aid, etc. So in the world of today, this function of prevention and risk reduction is not always covered entirely or sufficiently by all governments or by other organizations. And this is why we have adopted also in WFP the practice to drive disaster relief and disaster risk reduction programs in parallel, including in those parts of the world in which traditional systems of government and development have already broken down. And I should probably also add that we try to use the disaster relief cycle as an opportunity to integrate risk reduction in the rehabilitation and reconstruction phase that generally follows after a disaster. There's always a window after a disaster in which decision makers are aware and open to talk about risk management, and we are trying to use this as an opportunity to build back better after these disasters. So in a nutshell, this is the reason why we have a climate and disaster risk reduction service in the World Food Program.
Thank you. And I think this is a great segue for the next question that I'd like to ask, which is something that is very dear to my heart, I must say, which is about the food security narrative, like the prevalent food security narrative. Because when we see food security just being discussed in the international community, this topic often comes accompanied by this argument that we need to produce more food, right, to maintain food security. And this gives a general impression that hunger is rising because there's just not enough food in the world. But I have to say this bothers me a bit because we do have evidence out there telling a different story about actually pointing to hunger as an issue rather related to access to food, so economic or even physical access, as we saw now during the pandemic, rather than whether there's enough food available in the world or not. It does seem like this narrative has been, at least to an extent, built on interests rather on the realities on the ground. But now I'm very interested on hearing your take on this. Because even though I'm speaking here of a picture of hunger on a global scale, I think if we zoom in to the context of where you work, I can imagine that you do in fact encounter situations in which there is simply not enough food, such as in conflict situations or maybe post-disaster contexts. So I'm just very interested in hearing, how do you see this? Would you say that food availability is the main issue behind food insecurity, or are perhaps other more pressing issues hindering food security that we should prioritize?
Yeah. For us, food insecurity really exists when people lack access to sufficient amounts of safe and nutritious food so that they can lead an active and healthy life. If people are food insecure, then they cannot grow or develop healthily. And many people think that this is only about quantity, but there are some other factors here as well. So when we look at food insecurity in WFP, we look at a combination of things. I mean, as you have mentioned, there are situations where it is about food availability. I mean, food must be available in sufficient quantities and on a consistent basis. So you need production, you need stocks in a given area, but it can also be about the capacity to bring food in from elsewhere. Food needs to be available. And then there is access to food, which is super important. And when you look around the world today, I think this is a key aspect of the current global food crisis that we experience. People must be able to acquire adequate quantities of food through purchase or through home production or barter or borrowing aid. Very often when we look into countries that are experiencing food crisis or emergencies, food is available on the markets, but it is too expensive and people cannot access it. So right now with global food price inflation, there is a huge lack of economic access to nutritious food. Physical access can be another problem. This can come on top of economic access. For example, when you have conflict or when you have climate-related disasters, such as right now in Pakistan with the floods, where a third of the country is covered in floodwaters, that interrupts access to markets, and you do not have physical access. And this can be another driver. And then there is another factor that is often overlooked, I think, which is whether people can actually utilize the food so that the food has a positive nutritional impact. So food needs to be cooked and it needs to be stored, and there needs to be safe feeding practices and sharing practices. So if somebody does not have a good individual health status, for example, because they do not have access to clean water and sanitation, then the food they consume cannot be utilized by the body. So even if the food is available, if it is accessible, if there are some other factors that really undermine food utilization, then you have food insecurity too. And I think you have already mentioned, we're concerned also about the stability of food systems, because we must have access to adequate food at all times. So we should not have people who lose access to food as a consequence of economic or climatic shocks or cyclical events such as seasonal rainfall varieties. So in short, you know, it's really a systems issue. We will not solve hunger by working only on the production side of things. We can also not solve hunger in the world by providing food to those in need with humanitarian aid on a consistent basis. We need to work on an integrated set of interventions that tackle all these dimensions of food security at the same time.
So when it comes to food insecurity and hunger, availability and physical access are certainly huge topics. And I'm interested in not only if people are eating and if they're going hungry, but what exactly they are eating. So when it comes to many main commodities like wheat, corn, and rice, a very small number of countries make up a majority of exports and reserves. is diversification of the world's food portfolio a necessary preventative measure that can be taken to lessen economic shocks that can affect peace and stability? And when it comes to these food systems and resources, what kind of other preventative measures should governments be looking at implementing?
Well, to my mind, diversification is probably the number one climate change adaptation strategy we need to employ. As you have rightly said, 80% of the global population depend on only three staple crops. And a very small number of countries controls the bulk of these global stocks. So if this were an investment portfolio, we would be very concerned because there is not a very favorable spread of risk in such a narrow distribution. So right now, people, I think, tend to feel the risks that come with such a concentrated globalized food system in the wake of political shocks, such as the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but we should be equally concerned about the climatic factors. So in some of the crop models I've seen that project crop yields into a world that is at least 2 degrees warmer, maize could lose anywhere between 9 and 29% in global yields by the end of this century, and wheat could lose between 7 and 22%. Right now, we have certainly a big problem that our globalized food systems are so concentrated. But a second problem is that we are quite aware about the risks that come with that, yet still we keep buying into a system of fewer and fewer crop varieties. So what we should be doing instead is capitalize on the huge genetic diversity we still have available on this planet and also reduce the carbon footprint of these agri-food systems. By the way, the same principle of diversification goes for energy systems too. I mean, we need energy to produce food and to process it, to store it, to transport it for cooking. So if we keep relying only on one energy source or only on fossil fuels, then this is a very vulnerable strategy because it's prone to economic and physical disruption. So to answer the first part of your question, diversification is a really big lever on which we can pull to make food systems more resilient. But there are other strategies too, and usually they go together with diversification. One is to help governments and communities anticipate climate problems, climate hazards before they turn into disasters. Over the years, we have certainly learned to use our skills in risk analysis, early warning, emergency preparedness to trigger what we call anticipatory action at the community level before humanitarian crises materialize. Or we are making more strategic use of nature-based solutions. So this is about programs that restore degraded ecosystems and harness the properties of soils and vegetation cover to store carbon and water, to prevent erosion, to act as natural shields against climate events. So very often when these programs are structured in a participatory manner and when they involve all livelihood groups that have a stake in a landscape, then the process of developing these landscape-based programs also have conflict prevention potential. And then maybe the third example that I would couple with diversification is financial safety nets that protect the most vulnerable people from catastrophic extremes. Maybe not many people know this, but the World Food Program is the leading UN agency when it comes to making climate risk insurance work for food insecure people. And these insurance products, they trigger payouts that are then available for smallholder farmers to basically recover from a shock on their livelihoods. Last year, 2.7 million people in 18 countries were protected with such climate risk insurance products that were developed or supported by WFP. So apart from diversifying food systems, I think we need systems to anticipate climate hazards, restore degraded landscapes, and to protect the most vulnerable with financial safety nets. Those are some of the things that I think we can respond to your question.
Yeah, of course. And I think you've already shed some light on this a little bit, but you've already rightfully mentioned the fact that these participatory formats and when it comes to preventative measures, working in communities is really important. So then when it comes to these highly vulnerable people in different communities that are largely the most impacted by climate change, maybe you can expand a little bit on these actions that WFP is engaged in and how exactly you're working to help these countries afford to take preventative action to counter economic shocks that can often expose young, unemployed people to things like recruitment from armed groups and greatly affect peace and stability.
In your question, you bring in the concept of vulnerability, which is, I think, a really key starting point for this kind of work. when you ask yourself the question why a particular household is vulnerable, then usually you end up realizing that there are several degrees of deprivation. People lack access to financial capital, but they may also lack access to natural capital, to energy services, to roads without potholes. They might lack access to information or education. They might not have any political capital because they are disconnected from processes of planning and decision making. And some of them might lose their social capital because networks of communities and kinship are breaking down at the intersection between climate, conflicts, and economic shocks. So vulnerability is really an integrated problem. And when you look at the reality of what you see in international development or climate action, then you very often come away with the realization that some of the support that the international community provides is very fragmented. So maybe one project by one organization might distribute cook stoves, and another project might provide access to microcredit, and yet another one might engage people on reforestation. But these projects and services do not always reach the same people. And this is, I think, the key issue that we have. I mean, the best way to strengthen the resilience of vulnerable people is to reduce this fragmentation and to integrate these services better. And to do this within our own organization, within WFP, but also through partnerships with other organizations within and outside the UN system. Because vulnerability has so many different dimensions, the solutions to vulnerability need to mirror these dimensions. And to do that, we need better integrated programs. And some of the things that I mentioned before, anticipation of climate hazards before they turn into disasters, restoration of degraded ecosystems, protection of the most vulnerable with safety nets, these are elements that need to be integrated in the programs rather than relying on only one strategy and then to hope that this will prevent livelihoods from disintegrating and it will prevent young unemployed people from joining armed forces. So to my mind, integration of programs is really key. And in order to do that, we also need partners who provide us with some more flexible funding, because this allows us then to build these interventions that work on different aspects of vulnerability at the same time and not only on one.
When it comes to these multidimensional problems that need flexible solutions, they can kind of be notoriously difficult to quantify when it comes to impacts as well as solutions. So when it comes to disaster risk reduction, do you have systems to measure successes? And what does a success look for you in these communities and in these contexts?
This is a really good question, because measuring the impact of disaster risk reduction is notoriously difficult, and it has always been. I mean, if a disaster risk reduction project is successful, then it must prevent losses and damages in livelihoods. And this is hard to measure, because the lives that do not require saving after a disaster, you know, they're hard to quantify. A big part of the answer, I think, lies in, at least for us, in the use of food security analysis at household and community level. So we have a very strong vulnerability analysis and mapping function in WFP that forms the basis for, on the one side, the design of all our operations, but it also tells us how food security evolves in a particular location. So prior to any intervention, we undertake an analysis of the food security situation in area. We might answer questions such as, who is food insecure or vulnerable in this community? Why are they food insecure? How many people are food insecure? Where do they live? What can be done to protect their livelihoods? And what has been the pattern after extreme events? For example, after seasonal floods, after the monsoon, I mean, where were the hotspots of hunger there? And keeping track of this data then allows us to measure which types of interventions have made a difference in a particular location. So food security as a proxy for vulnerability for us is a really, I would say, well-established method. Economic analysis is another important way in which we track the impact of disaster risk reduction. For example, in 2020, the WFP country office in Bangladesh has provided cash transfers to people 4 days ahead of a big monsoon flooding event based on early warning forecasts. So rather than after the disaster has already materialized, we have provided cash-based transfers before that. So around 145,000 vulnerable people have received an early warning message plus some cash that was equivalent to about 2 weeks of food expenditures. And then we looked at how this way of working has compared with conventional emergency response. And we found that for one, the aid has reached affected households up to 100 days earlier than conventional response, and that households were 36% less likely to go a day without eating during the flood. We also saw that the cost of the emergency response operation after this particular event was only half as expensive because people had been able to protect their livelihoods and many household assets. So in this case, we have really compared the costs of a conventional emergency response with the costs of anticipatory action. And this then shows us the difference in the different ways of working. So those are two examples.
That's actually a very, very interesting example because we don't get to hear enough from examples of early warning measures. I mean, we hear us talking about it, implementing them for the future, but listening to examples, it's just very interesting because those are the things we should be looking at and learning from to apply in other examples, of course. Thanks a lot, Gano. I think you made a few very important points, especially highlighting the importance of all the four dimensions of food security beyond this focus on availability that we often see, also crop diversification and the diversification of energy sources and how this is related to food security, and also the focus on interventions that are looking into vulnerability, very important one. We can perhaps now look a little bit towards the future, the near future, so to say. COP27 is around the corner after all. I just wanted to hear from you, what particular issues would you like to see on the table of the climate community this year?
We generally go into COP meetings communicating that the climate crisis is also a humanitarian crisis. And by now, I think it is clear to everyone who follows the news that we live in an era of loss and damage. That is one in which mitigation efforts have really not been fast enough and adaptation limits have been reached. And as a result, we are now confronted with more loss of life and more damage to food systems that are so critical to sustain life. So one thing that will certainly happen is when we go to COP27, we will bring the numbers we work with every day. I mean, we are looking at 828 million people who go to bed hungry every night, and the sharp increase in the number of those people who are facing acute food insecurity as a result of shocks of some kind. So this number is especially worrying because it has increased from 135 million people in 2019 to 345 million people today. And we have 50 million people in as many as 45 countries teetering on the edge of famine. So in this big picture, I think we will try to show how weather extremes play a role. Last year, climate extremes were the dominant drivers of acute hunger in 8 African countries, with 23.5 million people in food crisis or worse, including in southern Madagascar and the Horn of Africa, where we have witnessed an unprecedented sequence of failed rainy seasons. And building on that, bringing this reality check, I think from there, we want to avoid the whole COP discussions to become an echo chamber. I mean, I think there is already a really good appreciation that climate change is real and that climate change is a problem, but we need to bring the discussion one step further towards solutions. Now, that is really, really very important. I mean, many practical solutions are available to avert, minimize, address loss and damage. We have talked about a few already. So restoring degraded soils and watersheds, protecting communities with financial safety nets and insurance, solutions to anticipate climate hazards. So all these solutions need to be brought to scale as soon as possible and in an integrated manner. We also need to make sure that more climate finance goes to the most vulnerable people on this planet. There are the places that have already started to unravel at the intersection between conflicts, climate extremes, and economic shocks. But climate finance is not necessarily going there first, because people seem to think that, you know, this is a case for humanitarian aid, and climate finance is more for longer term adaptation in the places where we still have functioning institutions. But, you know, the real climate front lines are in places like South Sudan, Afghanistan, Yemen, as much as they are in countries that are not already engulfed in social tensions and conflict. And then lastly, I think we want to show at COP27 and beyond that climate action and the transformation of food systems can really go hand in hand. So in other words, you know, when we transform our food systems in a positive way and make them greener and more diversified and more resilient, then we will make a lot of progress on climate action as well. And conversely, you know, strategic climate investments can help to transform food systems. So those are a few messages that I think we will need to bring to COP27.
Speaking of integrated and also scaling solutions, looking even further in the future, in March, Antonio Gutierrez called for ensuring that every person on Earth is protected by these early warning systems within 5 years. So my question to you, this of course sounds like a very necessary step in order to help fight climate extremes and some of the drivers of hunger that are increasing year by year, but is this feasible within this time frame? And also taking it a step further, how can these early warnings be also leveraged into early action?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I must say we really like this goal that our Secretary General has announced. It's really measurable, it's simple, it's time-bound, and it's what we need at this point. And I think if we look at what is possible in terms of mobilizing a large number of countries for certain global issues, then we certainly have the global response to the COVID-19 pandemic as a reference point. So in a very short time, you know, systems were built for COVID-19 prevention, testing, monitoring, vaccination. And with this in mind, I would definitely say, yes, it's possible to tackle big global issues if we agree that this should be a priority. In terms of early warning systems, it's a slightly different proposition, though, because the devil there tends to be in the details. For one, we are starting from a situation in which one third of the world's people, mainly in least developed countries and small island states, are not covered by early warning systems. So very worrying knowing that climate impacts are bound to get worse. So we're starting from a very low baseline. Another difficulty is that early warning systems are very context specific, not only in terms of the different types of hazards that they need to detect, but also because some countries do not have any functional observational networks to build on. Again, you know, in countries like Yemen, South Sudan, or Afghanistan, there is no stable network of weather stations that would allow consistent or comprehensive monitoring and modeling of weather data at the local level. And then another factor, probably the most important one, is that early warning systems must not leave anyone behind. So we need functioning channels to reach everyone with warning information who is in harm's way. And unlike here in Europe, we do not have 100% coverage with high-speed internet or telecommunications in many of the most vulnerable countries. So apart from SMS, we also need to work with traditional systems like radio messages, volunteer networks, writing messages on public boards and transport stations, etc. So you can see, you know, building early warning systems in a country can be a very complex endeavor that requires a lot of institutional coordination, a lot of finance. Countries such as Bangladesh, who now have one of the most advanced cyclone warning systems in the world, for example, they are looking back at decades of investment. So we can expect that certain countries will not be able to build their own early warning systems in the next 5 years, but we can certainly draw on global or regional systems in order to make sure that these countries do not remain disconnected from that goal. I think this maybe is I'm not sure whether I have answered your question sufficiently, but I would certainly say it's realistic, but we need to be technologically innovative in order to cover every country.
I think that's a nice, at least positive look to the future.
And there's only so much that we can actually look into the future and answer these questions, right? So it's more about getting your take on this. And speaking of leaving no one behind and on inclusion, which you already mentioned, we couldn't leave today without talking about farmers, of course. Farmers are absolutely essential for humanity. But in these times, in times of climate change, and also with agriculture coming into the limelight for its own impact and for its own contribution to climate change and environmental degradation, the farming community is now caught between a rock and a hard place. So I wanted to ask you, what role do you see for farmers? So what role would you see for them to become agents of positive change around all these issues that we spoke about today? And also, what kind of support would you say that they need to take up this role?
Yeah, I think we touched on this a little bit before. I mean, farmers are indeed key because they live and work at this intersection between food systems and climate action. So they're really very important agents of change. And when you look at our current food and farming systems, then, you know, many of them are not really sustainable. I mean, they cause up to a third of global greenhouse gas emissions, which then accelerates global warming. And this warming then boomerangs in the form of climate extremes, which then breaks down supply chains and drives food prices, and in many countries also cause hunger and malnutrition. Farmers can do something about this in various ways. For one, they are the guardians of landscapes, and their choices can determine if the soils of tomorrow remain able to sequester carbon, whether agriculture will be resource efficient or whether it will be wasteful, whether we will have a high level of agrobiodiversity or a low one. But no farmer is an island. I mean, farmers are embedded in larger policy frameworks, which incentivize or prohibit the use of certain practices or inputs, and which also determine how resilient our food systems really are going to become. And so many farmers make some of their choices dependent on the prices of fertilizer and energy. They link up with systems for processing, storage, and transport. And at each step along the way in an agricultural value chain, we have opportunities to either introduce cleaner and more resilient technologies or go the other way. So to my mind, the policy framework plays a big role in incentivizing a positive way and a positive future for the world's farmers. I think it won't be realistic to roll over the responsibility for food systems transformation entirely to farmers themselves. There needs to be an institutional and policy environment that helps farmers to do the best things for our food systems, but also for our global climate.
Absolutely. It's everyone's problem and everyone's responsibility at the same time, I would say. Let's do a quick recap. So today's guest, WFP's Chief of Disaster Risk Reduction, Gernot Laganda, walked us through some of the key points behind reacting to and preventing climate-related disaster. The World Food Program is a humanitarian agency, and it is, of course, equipped to react to rapid onset events, such as war and conflict, as well as climate and environmental disasters. But the best way to go about these events is to apply anticipatory action. And these can be preventative measures, of course, because the best disaster is the one that doesn't happen. But anticipatory action is also about reducing the impact of these events, or cushioning the blow, as it were. And this means working with approaches such as nature-based solutions, for example, to increase coastal resilience that reduce the impacts of flood. It also means creating financial safety nets among vulnerable populations before disaster strikes, so that these populations can have better resilience to endure them and maintain also higher levels of food security in the aftermath of disaster. As we saw in Gernot's examples, this is more than just a hypothesis. There is evidence demonstrating that anticipatory action has led to better outcomes in the aftermath of disaster. We also heard his take on the kind of measures that the international community can take to support these goals. These include investing in the diversification of crops and also energy sources, as well as reducing fragmentation of services and programs, which often address individual issues such as land restoration or cash transfers, without a comprehensive integration between these often complementary goals. More flexible funding, which allows for this kind of integration, would be a great step in this direction. And finally, looking ahead at COP27, Gernot reminded us that food system transformation is climate action.
Gernot, thank you so much. You gave us a great overview of the things that you're doing over at WFP and also the kind of challenges that you have.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here with us today and sharing your insights about these preventative measures and how we can prevent disaster and risk in the future.
Thank you very much for the invite. These were great questions and I enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks so much.
Great, thank you so much. This was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. We will be back with another episode in a few weeks. Follow our latest updates on Twitter under Climate Diplo. Thank you for tuning in, and until next time, goodbye.